As per plan, the handout in front of you is not covering any of today's material. The handout is meant as a summary of sorts of what we covered primarily yesterday. It's largely taken from my own notes, so that, as you know, last week we went through various sections step by step of Isaiah 29, and we kind of drew some things out of that, primarily some questions that illustrate what we should ask ourselves so that we are not like those warnings in Isaiah 29. So when I say Isaiah 29 is a warning, we remember that it's a warning to who, primarily, in our day and age?
To ourselves,
as Christians. Now, within the context of the text itself, who primarily, or who's the immediate warning to?
Israel,
that's right. It's a prophecy, you could call it, but it is a scripture that deals with the time of Christ and with the people who would call themselves the people of God during the time of Christ. So we understand that that's the immediate context, but we're making the application to us as Christians today, since in some manner we are just categorically similar to Pharisees, and that Pharisees had faith in God, and we too have faith in God. So therefore, the warning to them would also apply to us, more so than, say, a warning just to an atheist or a person who has no faith. Nancy, you got a comment?
Well, the Isaiah 59 passage, the children of Israel had pharisaical characteristics almost from day one. So it's not specific to the Pharisees. The Pharisees are just a continuation of the attitudes and the rejection that the Israelites have had for God for many, many years.
Well, and up and down throughout the course of their history. And when we get into that next circle of focusing exclusively in on the world of Jerusalem, we're going to delve into that concept a little bit more. And even in this section of the class, when we talk about the various groups of Jews, you know, whether they were of the Eastern diaspora, and we'll get into what those terms mean, or whether or not they were Hellenistic or of the Western diaspora, and how those kind of things played against each other, and in this concept of being separated. And so on that point, who can tell me what Pharisee means? Sharon. Okay, what else did we apply to it, or did we read into it, other than the direct translation of a separated one? No, this is from the root word itself.
The separation from sin.
Yes, that's a part of being the separated one. Scott? Yes, and what did we go to look at? What passage of Old Testament scripture utilized this same root word which Pharisee comes out of?
Israel. Wait,
I can tell you. Nehemiah 8:8. How is the word translated in Nehemiah 8:8? The word is peresh. So in other words, in Nehemiah 8:8, all right, she's about to come in, and I'll be able to see if she's in uniform. But in Nehemiah 8:8, it translates, yep, she is, this word peresh clearly. And there's a note in most Bibles that say paragraph by paragraph and with interpretation. And we looked at that and we applied the whom! That was my idea. Yes. All right, so this word Pharisee from the root word peresh. We'll get back on topic here. We find it in the Old Testament only literally a handful of times, five times. And we looked at Nehemiah 8:8, where this word is translated into English as clearly. Other versions may translate it into a different word, but it signifies a meaning of to go through the scripture in that particular context, you know, step by step, paragraph by paragraph, with interpretation, really dwelling on the word, okay? So again, it literally does mean separated one, okay? And as Nancy kind of mentioned in the beginning, you know, that's been an aspect of the Jewish nation since its inception. The idea of being special or holy or set apart. I don't know that we would ever say superior. I think that that's where that sense was abused in their own minds. that sense of being entitled or special. But we looked at Nehemiah 8:8 to add or to flesh out the meaning of the word Pharisee with the idea that it's my opinion that Pharisee was not a term bestowed upon this group of people by their enemies. We think of it in that manner now, but they refer to themselves as Pharisees, and it seems to be something of a badge of pride. And so we would infer from that that it is a name that they applied to themselves, and that it probably also had to do with the concept of looking over the scripture paragraph by paragraph in a detailed manner, studying the interpretation and trying to bring the interpretation out of that. So I want to keep that in mind because I think it becomes crucial to understanding the full context of the Pharisees themselves. So why are we studying the Pharisees? Again, this is all part of our review. Somebody give me one reason why we're even taking this topic and spending however many weeks that y'all can bear me studying it.
It was showing their arrogance.
Okay. Well, so, but why are we studying this particular topic? That's absolutely, and that's really our primary objective in this class. What are some other reasons that we're studying the Pharisees, Scott?
It's important to understand what was going on at the time of Christ.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So that's another objective of ours. That's our third objective, to really understand better the context in which these Pharisees operated, and furthermore and more specifically, understand how they interacted with Christ, what were their concerns, and how those concerns were dealt with in their interactions with Christ. What's another reason we're studying the Pharisees? Sharon?
Better understand why we follow their traps.
Correct. So Nancy kind of touched, or this idea that Nancy expressed in the beginning, this whole thing with the Pharisees having this kind of arrogance or this sense of entitlement, separation, holiness that wasn't deserved. That's a trap for us, and we want to try the best we can, to the extent that it's possible, understand how these people who most likely started out with this zeal for getting back to the Word and really living by the letter of it, how they got so far off track after the time of Ezra and Nehemiah to the point where they're the example of what we don't want to be. Okay, and that's our secondary objective. Another reason why we're studying them is that they're the primary opposition group. And as we've already covered in the last lesson and the lesson before that, there's Old Testament scripture that points to them, and we know that it points to them because Christ references that section in Isaiah chapter 29, pointedly at the Pharisees. So that's going to bring us up. Now, on your little handout that I just gave you, okay, again, that's a real quick kind of summary of what we covered last week. And I wanted to hand that to you because I consider those three sections there as themes to this class. Again, all tied to that primary objective that we want to analyze ourselves, we want to check ourselves to make sure that we are avoiding this example. So you see those three themes outlined there, and we discuss them in the context of Isaiah 29. So, yes, Tracy. There may be typos. It would be self-righteously hypocritical of me to claim that I have perfect grammar and spelling. So the basic themes, and again, things we want to keep coming back to, okay? We want to check our hearts. We want to make sure that the things we are doing are with intention, and the things that we are doing that our whole heart is invested in them, that they're not routine, that they're not our own traditions, that they're not out of obligation. We want to check our minds to make sure that we don't get into a habit of thinking like Pharisees thought, or of thinking that the verse comes to mind, take heed lest he fall. If anyone thinks he stands, take heed lest he fall. There's lots of warnings throughout the New Testament letters that even those of us who have that confidence and who have that knowledge, we still must be humble, and we have to have that mindset of humility when we approach the Word of God, and especially when we approach others. And then also to and then the literal sense, checking the things that we say and the things that we do, how we treat each other, how we treat those that are not members of this assembly, those who are members of churches who maybe teach false doctrine, and people who have no faith whatsoever, and even those who might be considered our enemies. You know, we're supposed to love our enemies as well. So we really want to dig into that concept in practice and how we treat that as well. So those are going to be some of the themes, and we drew them out of Isaiah 29. So fast forwarding to where we got to at the very end of the class last week. Okay, I had written this up on the board. We observed that best guessed estimate of most scholars, historians, anthropologists, whatever label you want to apply to them, is that the world at that time, the time of Christ, contained about 300 million people. And we notice that that's about the size of our country today, which quite frankly tells you how far we've come in terms of our ability to produce food, and we'll talk about that a little bit tonight, and our technology and disease and everything else. So that places it a little bit in context of what the world was like in that time, that really the world could only sustain a population that's equivalent to the current, to the present-day United States. We observed that, again, best estimates, the Roman population was about 50 million people. The censuses, depending on the emperor, would go up and down, whether or not they counted slaves and freemen or citizens or etc. So best guess estimate, about 50 million. And the Jewish population at about that time, again, best estimate being 5 million. So we observe all this, not to memorize statistics, but to observe the fact that, again, the trick question from last week, where did the Jews live? All over. When we read through the Gospels and when we think of the Jews, and for an obvious reason to this day, we tend to focus in on, from the Suez Canal up to about here. We think Palestine. We think that's where the Jews are, whether it's today or whether it's reading through the Gospels. But that loses some perspective on just how large this nation was. You know, we recall the promise to Abraham that God would make these people a great nation. Well, I don't know, I can't say this for sure, but I would say that 6% of the world was a pretty big nation. And probably, if not the largest nation in the world at that time, certainly among them. Now, what might strike you odd about this is that here's this nation that perhaps has more people than any other nation or country or kingdom or empire. Maybe not empire, because that would be a conglomeration of nations, but any other kingdom spread out all over the world, and yet they're conquered. They've been conquered by the Assyrians, they've been conquered by the Greeks, and they've now been conquered by the Romans. So when you conquer think about it. If Russia or China were to invade this country and take control of it, do you think they'd really have total control over us? No, we've got 300 million people in this country, most of whom are devout Americans. So you think about that percentage, 10% of the population, a full 10% of a population that consists of many, many conquered peoples, which are allowed primarily or mostly within the Roman Empire to maintain their own identities. They're allowed within the Roman Empire to maintain, for the most part, their customs, their religions, their way of life. So this is not like it was under Alexander the Great, where they tried to normalize everybody into this Hellenistic or Grecian culture. The Romans were different in that sense. But a lot of people, a lot of Jews, all throughout this region, we observe that primarily to make the point that, it's really not surprising in retrospect that the Romans would be so fearful, maybe not fearful, fearful maybe isn't the right word, but would be so concerned with sparking a Jewish uprising, or that they would be concerned with the affairs of the Jews, who largely wanted to keep to themselves. This is a big portion of the population. In a couple weeks, or maybe next week, depending on how far we get, we're going to see kind of how they differed, those groups within the Jewish world. So, again, a lot of Jews, really, really large population. And just as a side note, if you're keeping fact to the trivia, today's Jewish population is only 16.5 million people. Okay, so that's only three times larger over the course of 2,000 years. That kind of gives you a sense of maybe what the Jewish people have gone through in that amount of time. And we're all well acquainted with some of the persecution that they've experienced. So, you know, the center of the Jewish world always was and always has been, and I would say to maybe a lesser extent today, has always been Jerusalem, okay? But their influence is widespread, and this is why they're able to curry favor with the various Greek emperors and even with the government of Rome. So I wanted to point that out to let us not forget that these Jews are not a small population, okay? So what I want to do is take a little bit of a step back, okay, from the Jewish world and just look at, you know, what is the Roman Empire in a very broad sense? What is this context that the Jews are living in of an empire? And what I want to look at it primarily from the standpoint of is, you know, when I say that we live in an industrialized world, most of us know what that means. Okay, when I say industrialized world, we primarily associate it with, well, industry. Go figure. Okay, whether it's production of goods and materials from steel to, in our day and age, silicon computer chips, whatever, commerce. That is the primary engine of our growth. But for someone like me who is a student of American history, you know, it really wasn't so long ago that even the United States was an agrarian empire, okay, where the primary modus of the primary mode of commerce or the primary traded good, if you will, was food. You know, when you have 50 million people in an empire, the primary goal of your economy is to feed them all. And so in this day and age, before the Industrial Revolution, okay, which didn't happen really until the 1800s, okay, so 1800 years after the time of Christ, you had this dominance of an agrarian empire. Well, what's an agrarian empire? Anybody want to give me a best guess? This doesn't have to be a technical definition, and go ahead, Rick.
The vast majority of people work is producing food, growing it, raising it, or harvesting it. That's what everybody did.
Yep, and do people grow rich on that?
No.
Yeah. So what does that mean about those in power and those who are the masses who aren't in power, typically?
Is that like the farmers today and our government giving them enough money?
No, I mean, here's what it comes down to. In this kind of an empire, okay, we're familiar with the middle class, or what we think of as the middle class. And we see that the middle class in today's society really has quite a bit of power. You can't win an election, you can't win power if you only cater to the rich. And in the same manner, you can't win power and you can't win an election if you only cater to the poor. Because we have this big, strong middle class that has a lot of power. Okay, not so in this day and age. Okay, when I say this day, I mean the day of the Roman Empire. Okay, it's primarily an agrarian economy, and Rick hit it on the head. The vast majority of the people, they produce food, okay, and they don't get to go down and just sell it to the market. You know, this is not like a mass farmer's market. They have them, bazaars, et cetera, et cetera. But the majority of people, they produce enough food to feed themselves, and then the rest of it is pretty much taxed away. Okay, so we think our taxes are bad, but, and they are, but in that day and age, a farmer's produce above what they could subsist on, what they could live off of, was taxed at up to 70% at times. Okay? Now, actually, for the richest in this country who don't utilize multiple loopholes and deductions that are there for them, that's about equivalent. But this is the opposite. This is taxing 70% of the poorest. So, you know, you have the masses of people that fall into the lowest class. And I'm going to use a model that I've read about. It may not be the best model out there, but I think it's going to help us to understand kind of the different categories of people that we might find in this empire. And then we're going to look at where the Pharisees would fit into those. Okay. But look, the primary purpose of an agrarian empire is producing food. That's the biggest export. Okay. You know, and it's, I want to go to my next chart here, okay? It's wheat, it's grapes, it's oil. You can't see the little emblems necessarily on here. Okay, this is just the region of Palestine, in and around Jerusalem, the places we read about in the New Testament, okay? And what we see, where's my little laser pointer? Okay, we see the different areas where various foodstuffs were produced, okay? So I may include this in your handout next week because it'll be a little bit helpful to look at up close, okay? But you have these different symbols here. Those are grapes, those are olives, dates, figs, pottery, wheat, fishing, etc., okay? So you can see here, this is the primary economies, just in and around Palestine. Okay, you've got wheat down here in Samaria and with some olives. You've got, obviously, fishing, Sea of Galilee, and in and around some of the port cities. Okay, you've got grapes in and around this area here of Galilee and whatever this area is over here. The vast majority of the people, this is what they do. Okay, they farm. And you know, really, the difference between a well-managed empire and a poorly managed empire, and you see this with the leaders, the Roman emperors, as time goes by, okay, is how much they are able to keep peasants safe so that they can produce, okay, how efficient their production is, and the more they're able to produce, then really the better the lives of everybody. Because what did we learn in Economics 101? The more of something there is, what does that relate to as far as the price of that something?
Cheaper.
Okay? The less there is of something, the higher the price. So the more food there was, the better life there was for everybody, not just because they got to eat more, but because generally the price of all their goods were cheaper. And during the time of Christ, the cost of living was reasonably low, even for that day. And so, and quite frankly, it was really after the destruction of Jerusalem that the empire starts to go off the deep end as far as its management. So what I want to look at here, and I'm going to put them on the board the best I can, is this model that I found. Again, this is not a perfect model. I'm not saying that it matches 100% with what the history of the Roman Empire might suggest, but I think it will help us understand the different groups of people, okay? So the first one we've already talked about, okay? We're going to focus on the lower classes, okay? We're going to call them the peasants, okay? They're primarily farmers. Okay, they grow the wheat, they grow the grapes, they grow the olives, the dates, the figs, etc., etc. Okay, they subsist. I'm going to use this word subsist. If you're not, it's kind of an old-fashioned word. If you're not familiar with it, subsist just means to, think of it as staying with your head just slightly above water. Okay, you're in an equilibrium. They're taxed very heavily. Okay, I mentioned that up to 70%. And they live primarily outside the city. Why would they live outside the city? This is not a complicated question, but why would farmers tend to live outside the city?
Can't afford to live in the home.
That's one reason, but what's a more obvious reason, perhaps? You got to have land to grow. Okay? So then the inverse is going to be true as well. You don't have a lot of these. You primarily have non-peasants, non-farmers within the city, okay? And we're going to look at those as far as the upper classes as well, okay? So when I say farmers, I truly mean those that grow stuff, okay? Because, again, using this model, there's another class, okay? It's called the artisans. T-I-S. Okay? The artisan class. Now, the laboring class or the peasants, 60 to 70% of the population. Okay, let me write that down. 70%. Okay, this class here, artisans, and I'll define it in a moment. Okay, they estimate this is, depending on the time frame, 3 to 7% of the population. Okay, now an artisan, they don't possess any power, okay, but they have a skill. Okay, so they're trained in something. What's the foremost? How do I want to pronounce this? Who's the most prominent artisan, someone with a skill, or somebody from a skilled background that we can think of within the Bible?
Carpenter.
Jesus, the carpenter. Okay? So, a unique or a defining characteristic of an artisan or somebody within this artisan class is they're not tied to the land. Okay? Because they don't need the land. They have a skill set. They're a little bit more mobile. Do we see that mobility even for Joseph and Mary and their family? The answer is yes. Who can tell me where we see that? Or just give me an example. What about right before Joseph and Mary are they're betrothed, where do they have to go for the census?
They have to travel to Bethlehem.
Okay? And then after the child is born, where do they have to go?
Egypt.
Okay? And then when do they, then they come back, where do they go? Okay, are they selling property along the way? No, they're not worried about their crops. They're carpenters. They have that mobility. Okay, when you think about God's, you know, providence and His care for His anointed one, you know, that's an incidental. He gave Joseph a job that allowed him to travel, or chose Joseph, you might say. So these, you know, they don't have the only way that this class gets power. And let me write this down. They have a skill set. Okay. This class only has power when somebody needs to usurp power. Okay, and so they round up all the people and get them, you know, rabbled up, and they storm the barricades, you might say. Okay, that's the biggest group, so obviously they're going to recruit. Now, the only way that these folks, those in the artisan class, get power is if their skill set is so rare or so in demand that then your upper classes start relying on them or needing them. Okay. Who are some, okay, so let me just give you a few examples. Carpentry, we've already pointed out. That was a skill set. Okay, what are some other skill sets? One of them is on this list, pottery. Okay, anybody who would know how to make pottery or, you know, all these vessels, you know, we remember from the wedding feast where Christ turned the water into wine that they had these big cisterns. Okay, that kind of product within this realm, it was very common that you had to have these big cisterns and pottery, etc., to store your items. It's not like they had refrigerators or you know, pantries. Okay, who also fishermen were considered are considered of this artisan class. Okay, because fish, you don't grow fish; you have to go out and catch them. And anybody who fishes regularly often will tell you that you have to be smarter than the fish, which either implies that you're quite dumb or that the fish are quite smart. You can choose. So who else, though? Exactly. Paul was a tent maker. Okay. For those keeping track, that's found in Acts chapter 18 and verse 3. Acts chapter 18 and verse 3, it references Paul as a tent maker. Now, Paul fits into another class that we're going to get into because we also know that Paul, in addition to being a tent maker, was a
Pharisee.
Okay, Pharisees don't fit into this artisan class necessarily, or at least to the best of our knowledge. So sometimes these artisans were peasants that had been forced off their land. Okay, so generally people wanted to be tied to their land, but if they were forced off the land, then they might have to develop a skill set in order to make their living. They too were primarily subsistence workers. Okay, yes, Sharon. There's no indication that Pharisees would really be associated with the peasant class, okay? There's no evidence that, to suggest that, and that's primarily taken from the fact that pretty much all the Pharisees we encounter are, first of all, literate and are able to study the word definitely from the Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Bible, and perhaps even from Hebrew manuscripts if they were educated highly enough.
Okay, and one last question.
Mm-hmm. We'll get to that.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. One thing to point out, though, okay, we looked at this map here to show us where these peasants primarily lived, okay? You know, in all honesty, they probably weren't as spread out across the empire as other classes. okay? Because, again, they're tied to the land or they are put on land to farm it. So you're primarily going to be in agricultural areas. Now, in and around, you know, this area, yeah, peasants. But in your major areas of trade, not so much. Again, big cities, no peasants. Okay. Let's look at some others. Okay. We're still in the lower classes. Okay, there's another class, again, using this model, the unclean class. Now, when I say unclean class, or when I use this label, I'm not talking about those who are physically disabled or those who have medical issues. Okay, although within the Jewish world they might be considered unclean, that's not what this label is being used to. Okay, they don't really know how much of the population, but the best guess is about 2% belong in this class. So we're not going to spend a whole lot of time on it. When they say unclean class, they're primarily referring to those that had to do jobs that today we would say other people don't want to do. Okay, so anything having to do with dead animals or anything having to do with, you know, taking out of the city, for instance, human excrement. Okay, we read of, some of us have read of the Dung Gate in Jerusalem. Okay, that's where they take all the human excrement and they put it outside the city because they were smart, smarter than most people those days, and even into somewhat modern eras. So these were jobs that would make a person ceremonially unclean, okay? It's not that they themselves are. Or, frankly, that they had such dangerous jobs, such as mining, that their health might deteriorate rather quickly, okay? So what I'm going to say here is just, I'm going to use a Mike Rowe, and if you know Mike Rowe, you know what I'm going to say. Dirty jobs. Okay, that's this class. Can anybody think of a biblical character that does this? And this one may be a little more obscure. Scott?
Tax collector?
Nope, we're not there yet. Turn over to Acts chapter 10. And verse 6. Acts chapter 10 and verse 6. He, that is Peter, is staying with a tanner named Simon. Now, when they say tanner, they don't mean Aaron and Jordan, not a relative of Aaron and Jordan's. What is a tanner? What would be a modern term we would use today for a tanner, perhaps? What was that?
Hides.
Yeah, they dealt with hides.
What's a hide?
Like leather. Okay, so you take an animal hide and or an animal skin, and they turn it into something useful. Okay, they had to deal with dead animals. Okay, and they tended to live by the sea. In this case, that bears out Simon, because they needed the water. They needed the salt water or that kind of cleansing to either dry out, especially salt water that would dry out the hide. Okay, so Simon the Tanner comes from this class. Okay, they tended to live on the outskirts of the cities, okay, because again, generally their work would be associated with things that were needed in the city, unless their skill sets, such as being a tanner, required them to be, you know, somewhere else near that resource. All right, the next one, the expendable class. And no, this is not a movie with Sylvester Stallone and a bunch of retired action heroes. There's a movie called The Expendables. Okay, I'm getting one nodding head. These, you know, they think that this is about, you know, 5 to 10% of the population, this expendable class. And when they say expendable, what they really mean is those people who have no use or no place in society. Okay, those who are sick, those who are disabled, those who maybe are criminal elements, you know, they have no other job that's honorable to do. You know, so when you say expendable, don't think soldiers. Sometimes when we think, oh, those that are expendable, in this context, we think, oh, that must be, you know, the drafted soldiers. The expendable class are those that really just have no place in society. They're the bottom. And we see these kind of people all throughout the Gospels. These are the people primarily that Christ goes to heal or to perform miracles on, because he's giving attention to those that have been discarded. And there's a powerful message in that. Okay? So again, no middle class. We're going to move in between. So these are your lower classes, okay? These are your lower classes. Your peasant class, your artisan class, your unclean class, and your expendable class, okay? We're going to talk about one class that's really in between, and then we'll get into the higher classes, okay? The class that we would say is in between the lower and upper classes is the merchant class, okay? The merchant class, these are your bankers and your shippers, those that engage in commerce. These are what we would think of really today as your industrialists, those that are involved in not the production, say, of minerals or metals, etc., but the transport and sale and management aspect of that class. Now, the merchant class, because they have money and because they have the ability, quite frankly, to control some of the key ingredients of an empire, you know, they don't have inherent power, but they certainly possess some measure of independence and therefore some measure of power. Okay? Trade houses. And when I say trade houses, these are things that we're not readily familiar with because all of our trade is managed online or through complex computer systems. You know, if you think of the old days, like we were there. In the old days, if you went into the stock exchange and you went into, say, the meat room these various categories of industry, they literally were bidding on the price of that commodity. And it was a very active thing, and that's what would set the price. You know, there used to be, even as early as, you know, the 1940s, the Farmer's Almanac. People would listen to the radio for the price of the good. The farmers would, okay? When you think trade houses, think that, okay? These are the people that are engaged directly into the merchant activity of an empire, and especially of an agrarian empire, okay? Did I put it up? No, I didn't. Did I write that down right? No, actually, I stole that from the previous one. We really don't know is the answer. We would probably like to think that they're pretty broad and well-established. They're probably 5 to 10%. They really don't have good numbers. You know, they were largely in and around major areas of trade. It makes sense, okay? They're going to be near ports. They're going to be in major cities. They're going to be anywhere where there's a hub of transportation. Whether it's a road or a port or anywhere a boat might stop, et cetera, cities, okay? And we definitely, you know, see these people within the Gospels. You know, when you think the money changers, well, they worked for somebody. Okay? When we think those that bought and sold the various sacrifices which were sold to the Jews, you know, they got that from somewhere. We don't have, I won't make you rack your brains for it, but maybe you can think of one that I couldn't. We don't have necessarily an example of somebody within the gospel who would fall into this class, or at least not directly. However, I would just pure speculation, and this is really out on a limb. If I had to speculate that somebody that we are well familiar with in the gospels was from this class, I would actually speculate that Judas was. And the reason is because Judas was entrusted with the funds of the disciples, okay? And there doesn't seem to be any dispute about that. We know that he was a crook and that he pilfered from it, but there's no indication that anyone other than Jesus knew that, but they seem to trust him to handle this thing. So again, pure speculation, really going out on a limb, but I might speculate that Judas could have been a member of this class, okay? All right. Merchant class. The upper classes are reasonably simple, and I'm going to end on the one that the Pharisees are in since we're running out of time, okay? But the first one of our upper classes, okay, the ruler. a class all unto himself. Okay, I don't need to really explain that. Okay, but the ruler would categorize everybody from the Caesar down to Herod. Okay, these are people that are in direct power. These are the people that all those taxes and all that money that's taken from people goes to them. And so depending on how greedy an emperor was, he could sway the prosperity of his empire. Okay, beneath him, you have what we'll call the governing class. Okay, the governing class, about 1% to 2% of the population. Give me a name of a member of the governing class that we should be well familiar with.
Pilate.
Pilate, exactly. Okay, so these are bureaucrats with power. Okay, they tend to be aristocrats. They tend to be well established over the course of their generations as far as their families are concerned. Okay, these are people like Pilate who are put into power. They're kind of like rulers, but they really only, you know, serve at the behest of somebody else. They're bureaucrats. They're modern-day senators and congressmen, etc. Okay, they lived in cities, again, primarily aristocrats. You know, this would include Sadducees, who were you know, really kind of the ruling class within the realm of the Jewish world. The chief priests and the elders, they would fall into this class. These are the people with power. Okay. I've got a note here that I want to read from a book of mine, but we don't have time for that. Okay, another class? The priestly class. Tax collectors are going to fall into the same category as our Pharisees. So, priestly class, okay, they're also members of the governing class, so really it kind of should be over here instead of beneath it. But, you know, the priestly class, their power kind of comes from two sources. Within the Jewish world, primarily from, hey, donations to the treasury of the temple. Okay, they have their own source of wealth because of their religion. But these are, you know, your priests. These are your, you know, high priests, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, they're also members of the governing class. At certain times, they may become members of the ruling class. But they're just really another class. You know, the Hasmonean, when I say Hasmonean, I mean, you know, the legacy of the Maccabees, this uprising that occurred, you know, really the last major event prior to the time of Christ. They would be considered, they were priests who became emperors. So they're kind of a priestly class, okay? So I'm going to erase all this. We don't have a percentage for them necessarily. I'm going to erase all this, and I'm going to put in our last class here. Okay, we're going to call these folks the retainers. And when you think retainer, don't think what you pay a lawyer to work for you on a non-hourly basis. Think retaining wall. Okay, these are the people that keep things in place. Okay, they can be bureaucrats. They think this is about 5% of the population. Okay, these people serve the needs of the governing class. So we have the bureaucrats. These are the people that are below them. They serve their needs. Okay, these are our tax collectors. We're very familiar with Matthew being a tax collector. The speculation, at least, of the author that uses this model, okay, is that the Pharisees fell into this class. What are some of the things that we know about the Pharisees that eliminate them from other classes? Are they peasants? No, because they're spending their time studying the Word and going through their rituals, which they have. Okay, where do the Pharisees primarily live that we can tell? Within the cities of Jerusalem or other cities. Now, when we read through the Gospels, we see that when Christ is out in Galilee and is preaching and he's away from the cities, the Pharisees come out to see him, implying that they weren't already there. Okay, so we think that the Pharisees are primarily located within population centers, not exclusively Jerusalem, but within population centers. Okay, they're a mobile class. And when I say that, I don't mean physically mobile. I mean they might fall out of favor and drop into an artisan class, or they might gain power and join the governing class. So this is a fluid group of people, much like you might say the middle classes today. You have people coming in of it, you have people coming out of it. Okay, the primary goal of these folks, okay, I'll just read some of this here. Soldiers, teachers, lower-level bureaucrats, certain religious leaders. Okay, we say the Pharisees because what do the Pharisees always seem to be doing? They always seem to be serving the Sanhedrin, or they're on a mission from the chief priests and the elders, or they're spying out what Christ is doing and teaching so that they can inform somebody else. That's probably the primary reason why we would say they fit into this retainer class. They serve the needs of the governing class. When we get into the specific history of the Pharisees, we're going to find that they became a primary opposition to those Hasmonean chiefs, okay, those elders, those descendants of the Maccabees that were in power. They become an opposition group to them. And when Alexander the Great's empire breaks up into four different districts, they gain a lot of favor with a certain queen. And we'll dig into that a little bit further. So these people have the ability to gain power. Okay? And these are also people that they really interact with all these other classes, the artisan classes and the peasant classes. And that's why you see the Pharisees have this big, broad, before Christ, popular support. So they, you know, they interact, and they're out, and they're seen, and they can be examples for people. Okay? And the most obvious of them, we already talked about it, Paul, being a Pharisee of Pharisees, would be a part of this class. As far as their money is concerned, they have more money to live off than just subsistence because, again, you think of Paul and the idea of him studying at the feet of Gamaliel. You know, these are people that could afford to go to school, who could afford giving up a job that would otherwise pay them. And we see Paul had a little bit of both. Okay, so it's not to say that these people didn't also have a skill, but they certainly weren't peasants. They didn't farm their own land. We're about out of time, but I got to where I figured I would get, which is through this model. Okay, I wanted to walk us through this because I want us to see how the different classes kind of interact with each other. Okay, and I want us to realize that when we study through the Gospels, you know, we don't see a lot of the peasants in their element. And when I say in their element, I mean we don't see a lot of them out farming necessarily. We see a few here and there. But, you know, we largely, unless we assume, and I think it's safe to assume, that when it says the multitudes followed him, as Christ is in and around Galilee and you know, down to Samaria and Perea, etc., I imagine he took a lot of his followers from that peasant class. But when we get into Jerusalem, we're really talking about those artisans and the retainers and your governing classes and priesthood classes, etc. So, speaking of classes, mine is over. So thank you for your attention. For next week, okay, it's just real short reading, but go ahead and read through Acts chapter 2, okay, and just verses 5 through 13, okay? And what I want you to focus on is familiarizing yourself where those different countries, which are listed in verse 9, are from. Okay, associate yourself, look it up online, and figure out where those countries are located on a map. Because that's what we're going to get into next week, is start to get into the different groups of Jews and where they come from. So thank you for your attention, and that's it.